Conspiracy U by Scott Shea delivers an urgent wake-up call for everyone who cares about the future of civil society and is concerned that universities today are failing at teaching students how to strive for truth, but rather guiding students to blindly trust theories driven by ideology. The book provides a roadmap for reform based on universal moral and intellectual standards and offers a way out of the culture wars that are ripping America apart. A perfect gift for anyone who is sending their children off to college. Available now for pre-order, found wherever books are sold.
Hello and welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about The Call of Cthulhu by H.P. Lovecraft. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Paul Lafarge, a professor of literature at Bennington College in Vermont. He's a novelist whose books include Houseman or The Distinction, The Artist of the Missing, and most recently, The Night Ocean, which is about H.P. Lovecraft and his friendships, and in fact, a lot more. You can learn all about Paul Lafarge and his work at paullafarge.com. He joins us by Skype as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station, WRFH in Michigan. Paul, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Well, thank you, John.
Why is The Call of Cthulhu by H.P. Lovecraft a great book?
So first, we should note that The Call of Cthulhu is a short story, and I'm tempted to open a parenthesis about the correct pronunciation of the name Cthulhu.
Well, that was one of my questions coming up, is how do you say this word? It's got that odd spelling, C-T-H-U-L-H-U. Explain for us why H.P. Lovecraft picked such a strange word and what he's getting at.
So most civilians pronounce it the way you do and the way I do, Cthulhu. But Lovecraft himself had the sense that it should be pronounced almost like you were trying to cough up a hairball, sort of Cthulhu. And there are people in the Lovecraft community who continue to pronounce that name as Cthulhu to this day. But it's a little, to my mind, maybe a little affected. It's like going into a bakery and saying, oh, I'll have a croissant.
So it sounds like a weird science fiction alien name or something. So, but why is this story by Lovecraft? Why is it a great book?
I think the best way I could answer that is by talking about what moved me in it when I first discovered it. And I read this story for the first time when I was probably 11 or 12, and I was living on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, which was a different place in the early 1980s than it is now. And for me, the great joy of reading Lovecraft and reading this story in particular was the idea that there might be a whole world of secret and, in fact, forbidden knowledge, which would reveal itself to the initiated and which would upend all of your beliefs about everything and replace them essentially with the belief that the world is a truly horrible place and that the people in charge aren't people at all. They're giant monsters from elsewhere in the cosmos that have slumbered at the bottom of the ocean for millions of years and which view humans as a kind of snack food or at best as a entertainment. And for a teenage boy growing up in New York in that time, that revelation rang strangely true. The world did seem to be a terrible place, and at 11 or 12, I did feel powerless in the face of all of the grown-ups and the institutions which were in charge of me and the world around me. And I was very willing to believe that the world was in fact controlled by creatures that really didn't care about us at all. It rhymed with my experience. And I think that read of Lovecraft is one which remains with me and which other people have and have had as well. The feeling of being caught in a system which hides itself from you, and the truth of which is that it doesn't care about you at all. If you've ever spent an hour on the phone with customer service for your credit card, right? You have this experience, or, you know, gone to war with a health insurance company about whether something is medically necessary. You have the experience of powerlessness and of being caught in a giant machine, which really doesn't care whether you live or die, which might maybe consumes you with snack food. And Lovecraft really captured that in a way which was concrete and vivid and easy to enter into in the imagination. The real world as it is enormously complicated, and mostly the things like credit card companies and health insurance companies are beyond our imagining. But Cthulhu isn't. Cthulhu is a giant bloated creature with a head like an octopus and bat wings and giant flabby claws, which he uses to snatch hapless humans up and pop them into his mouth. And that's an image that you can work with.
We're going to talk about all of that. The themes of this story, the author, what he's trying to accomplish, the monster with the bizarre name at the heart of the story, and a whole lot more. Let's begin with the start of the story, The Call of Cthulhu. The narrator is shuffling through some family papers, and he reads a bizarre story about the visions of a disturbed artist. Paul, what's going on here, and how does this story take off?
So this is a story about a young man living in New England, like Lovecraft himself, who inherits from his granduncle a collection of papers which seem incoherent on their own, but which, when our narrator puts them together, suggest the existence of a cult of Cthulhu, a secret organization of lunatics, you'd have to say, and other malevolent people who are trying to raise Cthulhu, this ancient alien creature, from his slumber at the bottom of the South Pacific Ocean. As we progress through the story, the action moves closer and closer to Cthulhu itself, until in the climactic piece, which is, I believe, recounted by a sailor who somehow managed to survive the incident, we read about the people who find this island, which has risen in the middle of the South Pacific, kind of near where that Malaysian Airlines or whatever it was flight went down. And they accidentally wake Cthulhu, and he eats all of them who he can get his hands on, and the rest flee. So we're moving closer and closer to the revelation that this monstrous being exists and that it can be awakened, and then it'll try to do its best to destroy humanity.
So it's a story of adventure. It's a story of horror. It's also a story of ideas, isn't it?
Absolutely. You can see that in the form of the story, which rhymes with the way the story begins. Lovecraft opens The Call of Cthulhu with a reflection on the horror of putting pieces of information together. And in fact, his thesis in this story, as in much of his work, seems to be that the more you know about the world and the more deeply you interrogate the nature of reality, the more horrible it seems. So the more facts you can assemble, the more you realize that this is a horrible, horrible place. And the form of the story mimics that as our narrator pieces one clue together after another to ultimately find Cthulhu itself.
The opening of the story, some of those famous lines Lovecraft ever wrote. I'll just read the first two. The first opening paragraph of The Call of Cthulhu is a Lovecraft entry in Bartlett's familiar quotation. So it's achieved that kind of mainstream success. But here are the first two lines of the story. Quote, "The most merciful thing in the world, I think, is the inability of the human mind to correlate its contents. We live on a placid island of ignorance in the midst of black seas of infinity, and it was not meant that we should voyage far." And it goes on in this way. He's got a pretty clear message here, doesn't he?
Yes, absolutely. His message here, it seems to me, is that as we learn more about the universe, as we stray from our placid island of ignorance, what we discover is enough to make us mad. It's alien, it's menacing, and it reduces us to a place of utter insignificance in the cosmos.
A lot of people, when they try to explain Lovecraft's philosophy, his worldview, whatever you want to call it, refer to it as cosmic indifference. What does that mean, and does that explain what Lovecraft is trying to achieve with a story like this one, The Call of Cthulhu?
I think it captures part of what Lovecraft is trying to achieve in his horror writing. Lovecraft does not write stories about demons. He doesn't write stories about vampires or ghosts or zombies. His vision of the world is at some level scientific. He writes about things which were plausible to him when he was writing, mostly in the 1920s and early 1930s. And he arrives at an understanding of horror which rhymes with that scientific point of view, which isn't that humanity is plagued by evil spirits or preyed upon by undead Transylvanians. It's simply that the universe doesn't care about us at all, and that for him the ultimate horror is that feeling of not being cared about, of living in a cosmos which is profoundly and thoroughly indifferent to the existence of human beings.
So he doesn't have the stock monsters of horror literature and horror movies, and yet at the center of this story, The Call of Cthulhu, you basically have Godzilla with tentacles. Right. And one of the challenges of this story, which I love, by the way, one of the challenges of this story is explaining what it's about and explaining this monster at the heart of it and getting people to take it seriously and think this is something more than like an episode of The X-Files.
I imagine there are people who take episodes of The X-Files very seriously.
maybe a little too seriously. But
yeah,
but you know what? Give us the apologia for why this is not just silliness.
I think that Lovecraft was trying to put a form on that feeling of profound alienation, which he felt in his own life and which he imagined, right or wrong, to be a part of the human experience in the 20th century and indeed in the 21st. And the image that he chose is a mixture of a bat and an octopus, and he describes it in various terms which seem a little bit silly to us now. But I think the fact that he has given it a shape is powerful because it gives us something to grasp onto in our imaginations. And Cthulhu is campy. There's no way around it. You know, if you look on the internet, there are Cthulhu tea cozies and all kinds of sort of plushy Cthulhus. There's a whole world of what's called cute Cthulhu, which is, you know, adaptations of this horrible monster as a charming bat, octopus, crab. But there needed to be a form. He couldn't simply have an absence at the heart of his cosmology. The other thing that strikes me about The Call of Cthulhu is that Cthulhu, the creature, has a motivation. So I'm just looking at the end of the story, and Lovecraft describes Cthulhu as the green, sticky spawn of the stars, which, let's face it, is not the most horrifying description you could come up with. Green, sticky spawn conjures images to mind, but they're not necessarily images of terror. Had awakened to claim his own. After vigintillions of years, great Cthulhu was loose again and ravening for delight. And I think that word delight is interesting. There's something about Cthulhu which represents not only the horror that we encounter if we probe the secrets of the universe too deeply, but which represents something in us, right? A kind of desire, a wish for delight, a wish for a kind of joyous, crazy release, which we can find if we interrogate ourselves past a certain point.
You're listening to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review, and I'd like to tell you about National Review Plus. With NR Plus, you get unlimited access to National Review's digital magazine, which means no paywall, all the issues in our online archive, and all the podcasts. But this is more than a digital subscription. It's a membership that includes access to our members-only Facebook page, members-only conference calls with NR writers, editors, and guests, members-only commenting on the site, and a lot fewer ads, including none within articles. To learn more, please go to nationalreview.com/PLUS. Paul, everybody should read Call of Cthulhu. I love this story, but it's really, for Lovecraft, just the start of a kind of movement in his body of work. We sometimes hear about a collection of stories called the Cthulhu Mythos, and Lovecraft himself never used this term, but it's been applied to a number of stories that he wrote. What are the Cthulhu Mythos?
The Cthulhu Mythos is essentially the cosmology that I was talking about earlier, the idea that there are, in these hidden places on Earth, at the bottom of the ocean or in the wastes of Antarctica, the remnants of enormously old alien civilizations which have not entirely died out. They haven't died out quite enough. And their representatives remain to be conjured up or awakened or disturbed, at which point they wreak havoc on the Earth. And there are various creatures which belong to the mythos. Cthulhu is probably the best known. There's the giant blob-like thing. I don't want to call it a deity because Lovecraft was a materialist, and his cosmos, his mythos really isn't in any way a kind of religious pantheon. But there's this giant blob-like Azathoth who's surrounded by insane flutists who plays some mysterious role in governing the course of things. And there's Nyarlathotep, the messenger, who there are a number of these creatures, and each of them has a role in the cosmic order. I think the power of the mythos, again, comes from its ability to give a very abstract sensation of being dwarfed by the universe, by being unable to understand the universe, a concrete physical form, so that instead of fearing that quantum mechanics just doesn't make sense to you, you can fear that Nyarlathotep has been summoned by some insane cultists in Massachusetts and he's about to do something terrible.
So he created this whole world. It doesn't have the richness of Tolkien, maybe, but these stories have these interconnections, and they take place in a fictionalized New England with towns with names like Arkham and Miskatonic University, which is kind of like Brown University in certain ways. And another item that pops up in the Cthulhu mythos several times is something called the Necronomicon, which has a legend outside of the works of Lovecraft, although he invented this idea of a forbidden book. What is the Necronomicon?
In Lovecraft's imagining, the Necronomicon is a book of magic, which is written by a character he calls the Mad Arab, and it contains spells for summoning creatures from his mythos and presumably for accomplishing other sinister magical ends. And those who read the Necronomicon have a tendency to become insane. It's as though the revelation that's contained within that book is so horrible that it causes people just to lose their minds, to be candidates for institutionalization and, you know, some nice New England insane asylum. One of the very, very smart things that Lovecraft did, unlike Tolkien, is that he distributed responsibility for his imagined universe among his friends, among other writers. So he would write stories which referred to Cthulhu and the Necronomicon and all of these other things. And so would the people he was friends with and people he corresponded with, people whose stories he read and edited. And it produced this weird effect. If you were a teenager reading Weird Tales magazine in the late 20s, you might stumble upon a reference to Cthulhu and Lovecraft, and then another reference to Cthulhu in a story by Frank Belknap Long. And at some point, you would begin to suspect that Cthulhu or the Necronomicon was real. And in fact, there were lots and lots of people who did and probably still do believe the Necronomicon is real. And someone went to the trouble of making a false catalog card for it that got stuck in the card catalog at the New York Public Library, you know, only feeding the flames of this belief.
It's like open source horror literature, and everybody could tap into it, and there are Easter eggs, and it creates this web of something that seems like reality. And then Lovecraft takes real history and mixes it with the fiction. For example, he has a line somewhere where he says John Dee translated the Necronomicon, and John Dee is a real figure from Elizabethan England. And if there was a Necronomicon, he's exactly the kind of guy who would have done that. It creates a kind of richness. Now Lovecraft wrote a lot of stories that are in this cycle. Call of Cthulhu is the best known. It's the one that kicks things off. We also have At the Mountains of Madness, The Dunwich Horror, Color Out of Space is connected in certain ways, The Shadow Over Innsmouth. Do you have a favorite, maybe a second favorite, and can you describe what it's like?
Sure. I think I love all of the stories that you mentioned. I think the one that has the most in it for me to keep thinking about is The Shadow Over Innsmouth, which tells the story of a young man who is on a kind of sightseeing tour of New England, and he discovers that there's this mysterious bus which goes to the town of Innsmouth, and it's not on any map, but he decides it's like the cheap way to get where he's going, and he wants to see something that's a little off the beaten track. So he ends up in Innsmouth, which is a town taken over by fish people, by human beings who have intermarried with some sort of undersea being that lives just off the coast in the Devil Reef. And they are in the process of claiming this town. They've been exchanging undersea gold and jewels for the privilege of remaining on land. And now they're well established, and they run all the churches, and they've kind of let the town fall into ruin. But you have this beautiful description of this guy wandering through a very well-described New England town. Lovecraft really knew his local detail. He's a great writer about New England, but it's populated by fish people who are skulking in and out of these buildings. And the story builds to several climaxes, one of which involves the narrator escaping from Innsmouth. But the final revelation of the story, can I say what it is? I'm afraid this is like a major spoiler.
I think it's okay if you need to turn off the podcast now, then do it. But you'll still enjoy the story even if you hear what's about to happen. So go for it, Paul.
Okay, great. So the final revelation is that this narrator is himself descended from the fish people, and that as he ages, he expresses fish-like characteristics more and more. And it ends with him embracing the horror which he has been repulsed by in his youth. These creatures who he found terrifying and alien and smelly and horrible in every way turn out to be his grandparents. And he looks forward to returning and immersing himself literally in the culture of his ancestors, the deep ones, the people who live in the ocean. And there's, again, this moment of joy. It's as if the characters have, Lovecraft's narrator has found the one way out of this problem of cosmic indifferentism, which is just to celebrate the horror, just to band with it, to become one with it, to enter into it, and to be happy about that. I don't know if it's a great solution. I don't know how generalizable it is for readers of Lovecraft, but it's a beautiful ending to the story.
Let's put Lovecraft and his work in a little bit of context. Lovecraft was born in 1890. He died in 1937 in obscurity and all of his fame essentially is posthumous. Call of Cthulhu, who was written in the late 1920s. How does he compare with the other great figure of horror literature in the United States, Edgar Allan Poe? And how did Lovecraft change horror literature into or shape it as we know it today?
Lovecraft was a great admirer of Poe. Lovecraft read Poe early and often and was enormously influenced by Poe. And you can see that influence in a number of ways. Poe uses a lot of adjectives at certain places in his horror fiction. If you go back and look at The Fall of the House of Usher, everything has an exclamation point and four adjectives appended to it. And Lovecraft picks up some of those tendencies as well. Poe is also, I think, at heart, a materialist. He's someone who was very interested in the science of his day. He was much less interested in the kind of supernatural as traditionally conceived. And Poe's best horror concerns things which fall into that category of the plausible or the barely possible, like Lovecraft. So in Poe's novel, the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym, this expedition sails southward until they reach the hole at the bottom of the world, which will lead them into the inside of the hollow earth, or maybe not. But the revelation and the kind of discovery that the characters make is ultimately a material revelation. It's about this world. It's not about the afterlife or anything to do with theology. It's a very scientifically inflected horror, and Lovecraft absolutely picks that up. I think that Lovecraft goes past where Poe ends. Poe has a real genius for breaking narratives off at the point when something is about to be revealed. So if you look at his manuscript Found in a Bottle, the person who has written this manuscript has been swallowed up by a giant whirlpool, a maelstrom, and has just managed to toss this bottle over the side of his ship before vanishing forever. And we never learn what's at the bottom of the maelstrom. And the same with Pym. We never actually see the inside of the earth. We just see them getting closer and closer. And Lovecraft goes there. He brings us to the edge of revelation, and then he reveals. And he says it's not just this unknowable cosmic mystery. It's Cthulhu, or it's the color out of space, which is actually this entity that is in some way knowable. And he's able to build around that the idea that people can know the secret of the cosmos, which I don't think Poe in his horror writing really believes. But for Lovecraft, they can know it, and it's mostly concealed. It's mostly secret. So if you want to find out, you have to really hunt for it. And I think that's very appealing.
You've already described how you discovered Lovecraft as a boy of 11 or 12. And my own story is not that different. I was maybe a little bit older, but definitely this is a writer from my youth. And I've always been nostalgic about Lovecraft. You can say whatever you want about this guy, but he holds a special place in my heart because of the age at which I discovered him. You went on not just to be an admirer of him, a fan of his work, but you wrote this novel, The Night Ocean, published in 2017, an excellent book. I've read it. I really enjoyed it. And I should also mention it deals with H.P. Lovecraft. Also has a couple of minor William F. Buckley Jr. references of all things, which I hadn't expected. And here we are on a National Review podcast talking about H.P. Lovecraft. But what compelled you to write that book about Lovecraft, and also give us an elevator pitch? What is the book about?
Those are going to be the same answer. I was having dinner with the poet and novelist Robert Kelly, who knows a lot about a whole lot of things. And one thing that he turns out to know a lot about is H.P. Lovecraft. And he asked me, I admitted that I was a longstanding Lovecraft fan and told some embarrassing Lovecraftian anecdotes from my youth. And he said, oh, did you know about Robert Barlow? And I had never heard that name before. And he told me the story of Barlow, who was one of Lovecraft's many correspondents. Lovecraft wrote some 100,000 letters in the course of his life. It's an inconceivable number of letters. And he had a long correspondence with Barlow in which they discussed Lovecraft's work and science fiction and horror in general and other topics of the day and their, you know, their sort of day-to-day lives. And as the intimacy between them grew greater, Lovecraft mentioned that he would travel through the South every summer. It was a thing he was in the habit of doing, and Barlow happened to be in Florida. And Barlow invited Lovecraft to come and stay with him, and Lovecraft did in the summer, I think, of 1933 or 1934. And against all expectation, Lovecraft stayed with the Barlows for something like 6 weeks, which was a very long time for him. He wasn't antisocial, but he was a person who quite often enjoyed being alone. And the other thing that makes this a little bit odd is that Lovecraft was 43 at the time of this visit, and Barlow had just turned 16. So there's a kind of question mark. What was this older writer of weird tales doing hanging out for 6 weeks in Central Florida with a precocious young fan? And no one knows the answer to that question. It's almost, you can draw some obvious inferences and you'll find very little evidence for them. But Barlow went on to have a fascinating life of his own. Lovecraft named Barlow as his literary executor, the person in charge of publishing all of his work after he died. And as you say, Lovecraft was unknown during his lifetime. So all the work, there was a lot of unpublished work, and there were a lot of people who were trying to secure Lovecraft's reputation after his death. And Barlow was young and disorganized, and he got essentially excommunicated from Lovecraftian circles for being a bad literary executor. And he went on to become a poet in Berkeley, California, a kind of modernist poet. And then he moved to Mexico City and became one of the great anthropologists of pre-Columbian Mexico, to the point where if you study the anthropology of pre-Columbian Mexico, the 1940s are still referred to as the Barlow decade. And he published more than 100 papers and books on the civilization, the empire of the Aztecs. And then he killed himself at age, I think, 31. So he had this very intense, very varied, and very memorable life. And I thought, well, this is actually it's a wonderful story. I think I want to write something about Lovecraft and Barlow. And the more I looked into it, the more interesting it got. And The Night Ocean very, very slowly grew out of that.
And so this wonderful story is a great novel called The Night Ocean. And if you're interested in H.P. Lovecraft, I recommend it highly. It's a terrific book. One more question, Paul, as we wrap up. What's the case for reading H.P. Lovecraft in our time? This is a new century. Lovecraft died long, long ago. Call of Cthulhu was written almost a century ago. Can he still haunt us today in pleasing or useful ways?
I mean, he certainly does haunt us. So I think in a way that answers the question of whether he can. And one of the things that I turn over in my mind when I think about him is that Lovecraft had friendships or at least acquaintances with some of the great American writers of his day. He was a cocktail party friend of Hart Crane. He was a friend or at least a kind of warm acquaintance of Theodore Dreiser. And those people were literary titans. And Lovecraft, compared to them, was an insect. He was a writer of pulp horror for a magazine read by teenage boys. 100 years later, Lovecraft's influence is enormous. Crane is read by poets and scholars, and Dreiser ditto. There are people who still love both of those writers, but their shadows have shrunk, and Lovecraft's has only grown. And I think that Lovecraft's ability to capture that feeling at once of horror and powerlessness, but then at the same time of the joy of finding things out and the delight of getting to the heart of this weird mystery makes him relevant to us now. I think our world has, if anything, become more Lovecraftian in the 90-odd years since he died.
Paul Lafarge, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about The Call of Cthulhu by H.P. Lovecraft.
John, thank you very much for having me.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at heymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is @heymiller. And last of all, a special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.